The novel Outlander came out more than 20 years ago. It featured a determined heroine who time travels from the 20th century back to 18th century Scotland. It was the first novel for author Diana Gabaldon.
Even she says she has trouble describing just what that book is about, but it grew into a series that has made her famous and wealthy. And now Outlander is a television series, which debuts tomorrow night on the Starz channel with a Z. NPR's Karen Grigsby Bates with an S from our Code Switch team caught up with Gabaldon recently at Comic-Con in San Diego.
Diana Gabaldon was speaking to a couple hundred fans who'd squeezed into a small theater during Comic-Con to hear her talk. Outside, a group of kilt-wearing laddies walked the streets passing out swatches of tartan emblazoned with "The Kilt Drops 0809, a mildly risque reminder of an important date. Gabaldon, she says her Spanish surname rhymes with bad to the bone, has a Ph.D. in quantitative behavioral psychology, something she describes as animal behavior with lots of statistics. She was a university science professor for years, but decided in her mid-30s she wanted to write a novel. Best way to do that was to write a practice book. That exercise became Outlander, the best-selling tale of Claire Randall, a young English battlefield nurse who inadvertently hurtles back two centuries to find adventure, intrigue, and, yes, romance. The first book was so popular it blossomed into a series. 2 decades and 7 big books after the original one, Gabaldon says, bookstores still don't know where to place her work because it contains elements of several genres. After her talk on the Now Quiet Theater's bare stage, Gabaldon says when she first made author appearances as an unknown, she'd craft a pitch for each prospective buyer.
Depending on who I was talking to, if it was a young woman, I'd say, oh, historical romance, you know, men in kilts. If it was a slightly older lady, I'd say, oh, it's historical fiction. If you like Shogun, you'll love this. If it was a young man, I'd say, oh, it's fantasy, you know, time travel, things like that, swords. And if it was a slightly older gentleman, I'd say, oh, it's military history.
Eventually, rather than contort herself to describe her series, Gabaldon took a different approach.
After a while, I took to saying, look, tell you what, pick it up, open it anywhere, read 3 pages. If you can put it down again, I'll pay you $1. So I never lost any money on that bet, but I sold a lot of books.
A lot. By several reckonings, the Outlander series has sold 25 million books since the original Outlander was published in 1991. It's been translated into 34 different languages. Now, Outlander, the television series, will premiere and extend Diana Gabaldon's reach yet further. It begins as Claire Randall is finally reunited with her husband Frank after peace is declared in 1945. The young couple drives up to the Scottish Highlands to reconnect with each other after having been separated by the war. Frank, a historian and former intelligence officer, wants to trace his Scots ancestry, so he's researching his family tree. While he's doing that, Claire goes off to collect plant specimens in the hills, enters a circle of standing stones, and is pulled towards the noise she hears from them. Puzzled, she puts her hand out to touch the stone and faints. When she awakens, she seems to be in the middle of a firefight between soldiers in 18th century British battle dress and kilted Highlanders. She thinks she has an explanation.
Perhaps I had stumbled onto the set of a cinema company filming a costume drama of some sort.
It isn't that simple. Somehow, Claire Randall is in 1743. She soon finds herself running away from her husband's ancestor, Captain Jonathan Blackjack Randall. Just as he's about to take her, in the 18th century sense of the word, she's rescued and then kidnapped by a group of Highland rebels who aren't sure of where her alliance lies. The conscripted nurse tends to a tall, injured redhead who turns out to be James Alexander Malcolm Mackenzie Fraser. And somehow, Claire has to come to terms with where she is. She reluctantly does that when Jamie Fraser points through the twilight to show Claire Inverness, the city where she'd been staying.
Where is it? Where's the city? It should be visible from here.
Inverness? Are you looking straight at it?
There were no electric lights as far as the eye could see. So as much as my rational mind rebelled against the idea, I knew in my heart I was no longer in the 20th century.
Claire's early adjustment from 20th century medical professional to the much more constricted role assigned to most 18th century women was rocky.
So far, I'd been assaulted, threatened, kidnapped, and nearly raped. And somehow,
I knew that my journey had only just begun.
Lucky for her, she would have Jamie, intelligent, deeply moral, and fiercely loyal to help her with the transition. Claire is forced to marry him for political reasons, but they soon become true lovers. The romance is a central thread that's woven throughout the Outlander books. Diana Gabaldone served as consultant to the television series.
And what do you think? Are you pretty happy with it overall?
I'm very happy with it. I'm just thrilled. It couldn't be better.
Apparently, Starz is happy, too. This year, there will be 8 episodes of Outlander beginning tomorrow, another 8 early next year. One of Gabaldone's best friends is George R.R. Martin, whose Game of Thrones series has broken records for HBO. The two enjoy a little friendly competition.
George Martin asked me, how many episodes are you getting? And I told him 16. And he said, what? They only give me 10.
Gabaldone says there will be a small Outlander novella sometime soon, but not one of the thick epics she's become famous for. That'll take a couple more years. For one thing, publicizing the current book, written in my own heart's blood, takes up a lot of time, as Gabaldone, with typical directness, points out.
Well, you know, if I wasn't here talking to you, I'd probably be home writing.
I'll shut up and leave now.
And then there's the ongoing battle to keep her Outlander books from being relegated solely to one category, as they are on Amazon.
At the moment, it's romance, and I have every expectation of being able to fix that, because I will be seeing Jeff Bezos in another couple of months.
Want to put money on who will win that fight? Remember, her last name rhymes with bad to the bone. Karen Grigsby Bates, NPR News.
And you can see a trailer for the Outlander TV series, as well as an excerpt from Diana Gabaldone's most recent novel at our website, npr.org. You know, this is lovely music, David, but I wish that we'd been playing George Thorogood's Bad to the Bone.
I think that that's what I was expecting and hoping for.
Appropriate. Anyway, it's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Steve Inske.
And I'm David Green.
Preservation of Yiddish as a spoken language gets a lot of attention, but it once also had a vibrant written tradition. Plays, poetry, and novels all were published in Yiddish until the time of the Holocaust. A great deal of these works can be found at the National Yiddish Book Center in Western Massachusetts. John Kalish reports.
The National Yiddish Book Center was founded by Aaron Lansky, who began his efforts to save Yiddish books in 1980, while enrolled in a Jewish studies program at McGill University in Montreal.
I started putting up notices in the Jewish delicatessen and laundromats in the Jewish neighborhoods, you know, that I'm a young grad student, I'm looking for books.
Lansky was surprised to learn that the offspring of Yiddish-speaking immigrants were throwing out large quantities of old books.
I'm racing around the city on a bicycle, and the piles in my apartment are getting higher and higher, and my teacher came over one night, and we started going through these piles, and we realized, oh my God, these are some of the greatest treasures of the Jewish people, and they're just here for the taking.
Large numbers of Yiddish books were first published in the 1500s. They were mostly aimed at women and poorly educated men who couldn't read Hebrew. In the late 1800s, there was an explosion in Yiddish publishing. Lansky says that in addition to translations of Tolstoy and Shakespeare, there were political tracts, science texts, and fairy tales translated into Yiddish. There were also short stories and novels by writers such as Shalom Aleichem and S. Anski making up the Yiddish canon.
It embraces all the great themes of all modern literature, the conflict between the individual and the collective, power and powerlessness, sexual awakening, I mean, struggles for social justice, war and peace. There's very little that you won't find in the pages of Yiddish literature.
The National Yiddish Book Center's headquarters is located on the campus of Hampshire College in Amherst, Massachusetts. It is a light and airy structure that recalls a wooden synagogue in one of Eastern Europe's shtetls or small towns. The oldest books are stored in a climate-controlled vault on the lower level. Newer books are upstairs on shelves. Books are still being published in Yiddish today in the U.S., Israel, Europe, and South America. Sebastian Schulman coordinates the center's program to translate Yiddish books into English.
In Yiddish, you say, reingefallen in a Schmalzgrube, and that means fell into a bucket of fat. you hit the jackpot. And that's really what I felt what happened when I got into Yiddish.
The National Yiddish Book Center pays people to translate a small number of Yiddish books each year. It has a website called Teich, where a community of 200 translators discuss the origins and meanings of Yiddish words and phrases.
We have one user who's a native speaker of Pennsylvania Dutch and really knows the sort of Germanic component of Yiddish, but he's weaker on the Slavic component of the language. And so we have users from Russia and Ukraine who chime in and say, well, this is what this means in Slavic.
The center is also publishing books. A Holocaust memoir written by a survivor of the Warsaw Ghetto will be the next release.
Rachel Auerbach became the only one of all the writers of the Holocaust to be able to base her memoirs on her own wartime writings.
Auerbach was a journalist who escaped before the ghetto was liquidated. Aaron Lansky says her notes were buried for safekeeping and retrieved after the war. She used them as the basis for a two-volume memoir.
These are an absolute unique document. They came out in Yiddish in Israel, had a very small readership, and were quickly forgotten.
Most of the center's books have been digitized. 11,000 titles are available online for free. The center says they're often downloaded by people living in religious Jewish neighborhoods like Brooklyn, where Yiddish is still widely spoken. But many secular Jews connect with the National Yiddish Book Center as well. Every summer there are programs for people who want to read important literary works or learn to speak Yiddish.
Wenn Shabbos Kodesh kommt zu gehen, was sagt man?
25-year-old Michael Yashinsky works at the Detroit Opera House and dreams of staging a Yiddish play someday.
It's not just about dusty pages. It's really what can be found in those pages and making it relevant to Jews of today or to anyone today who's interested in this amazing culture that flourished in Yiddish land.
The National Yiddish Book Center shares books with libraries around the world, including the National Library of Israel. For NPR News, I'm John Kalish.
The final book in author Lev Grossman's best-selling Magicians trilogy comes out this week, The Magician's Land. It's a literary fantasy inspired by Narnia and Harry Potter that tells the story of what happens to brilliant young wizards when they grow up and have to deal with the world. NPR's Petra Mayer caught up with Grossman at San Diego's Comic-Con.
Lev Grossman is a fantastic and slightly terrifying person to see Comic-Con with. He has no problem taking unspoken insecurities and dragging them out into the light.
What is going by over there? I can't even tell.
When you're walking around Comic-Con, you're constantly gauging your own cultural literacy, and I frequently come up short, like in the case of that appears to be a radish with blue tentacles and a stripy hat. I got nothing.
I have to admit, I didn't know either. But despite Grossman's self-deprecating manner, he's really not lacking in cultural literacy.
I grew up in a house full of books, plus one to nerdiness already. My parents are both English professors, and they were great champions of the canon and the high works of Western civilization, also Eastern civilization. So in order to irritate them, I became a devotee of all things nerdy and unrespectable, and it worked. They were irritated by that.
But Grossman says that high-low cultural divide just isn't valid, and he's spun his youthful quest to irritate his parents into a profitable adulthood. He's a book critic, and as he puts it, a sort of office geek at Time magazine, and he's just released the last volume in his best-selling Magicians trilogy. It's the story of high schooler Quentin Coldwater, who discovers not only that he has wizardly powers a la Harry Potter, but that Fillory, the magical land he loved to read about as a child, is in fact real. There are no wholesome mugs of butterbeer here, though. Quentin and his pals curse, drink, and screw up their lives. They're much more like people you might actually know than lofty fantasy heroes. Grossman says the series was inspired by the wait between books 5 and 6 of Harry Potter.
It was a long wait, and I started thinking both about how passionately I felt connected to this character, and yet also how different my life was from his. And I started thinking about how could I tell a story like that, but tell it in an adult way with sort of all the adult realities people are dealing with when they're in their 20s and 30s.
Now, we know Harry Potter comes out all right in the end, Grossman says, because we see him in an epilogue dropping his own kids off at Hogwarts.
How does he get there? What is it like when he doesn't have Dumbledore anymore to give him friendly advice? He doesn't have Voldemort anymore to have big spectacular battles with. It's a very different kind of story, a very different kind of fight. It's a struggle to figure out, you know, what magic is for when it's not obvious.
That story about the struggle that talented kids go through when they grow up, it sounded, well, kind of autobiographical to me. And Grossman says that, yes, there is a little bit of himself in Quentin Coldwater.
My 20s were, they weren't even a spectacular failure. They were like an unspectacular failure. I just flopped out of so many careers. I had such a hard time figuring out who I was and where I was going that when I turned 30, one of the things I started doing was thinking about how to tell the story about this horrible, difficult time I'd been through and tell it through the lens of fantasy.
It's a great time to be writing fantasy, or reading it, Grossman says, because the genre is evolving at a fearsome rate and people are doing things with it that haven't really been done before. He points particularly to Susanna Clarke's 2004 novel, Jonathan Strange and Mr. Norrell.
I think the style owed a lot to Jane Austen. It was very beautiful, very lyrical, very, very funny, and very real. And you felt yourself reading it, and you felt yourself being moved in ways that you were accustomed to be moved by literary fiction. She was showing that fantasy could do all that stuff. There really are no limits.
But one of the things fantasy does best is give misfit kids and adults a home inside its pages, which might account for maybe the most surprising thing about Lev Grossman. Like me, he used to love Anne McCaffrey's Dragon Riders of Pern books.
I don't usually find guys that'll cop to being Anne McCaffrey fans. I always thought of those as chick books.
Maybe they are, and in my innocence, I didn't know. But The White Dragon was a book about me.
So you're the lord of a minor holding, and you have impressed a runt dragon accidentally? Do you still have him?
You may not know that about me, but yay. He's got his own house now, works in the healthcare industry. He's doing well. We stay in touch.
Petra Mayer, NPR News.
Julie Schumacher's first novel, The Body is Water, was a finalist for the Penn Hemingway Award. She's a faculty member in the creative writing program at the University of Minnesota, a job that presumably gave her some raw material for her new academic farce, Dear Committee Members. Book critic Maureen Corrigan has this review.
For all you teachers out there contemplating the August calendar with dismay, watching, powerless, as the days of summer vacation dwindle down to a precious few, I have some consolation to offer. A hilarious academic novel that'll send you laughing, albeit ruefully, back into the trenches of the classroom. Julie Schumacher's novel is called Dear Committee Members, and one of the reasons why it's such a mordant minor masterpiece is the fact that Schumacher had the brainstorm to structure it as an epistolary novel. This book of letters is composed of a year's worth of recommendations that our antihero, a weary professor of creative writing and literature, is called upon to write for junior colleagues, lackluster students, and even former lovers. The gem of a law school recommendation letter our beleaguered professor writes for a cutthroat undergrad who he's known for all of 11 minutes is alone worth the price of Schumacher's book. Our professor, Jason Fitger, was once a promising novelist, but his career fizzled when he returned to the well of his failed marriages and affairs for story material a few too many times. Now in late middle age, Professor Fitger finds himself stuck in the intellectual Sargasso Sea of the undistinguished Payne University. The English department where he teaches, like real-life English departments everywhere, is hemorrhaging students who are pragmatically choosing to major in disciplines like international finance and computer science. Indeed, while in the classroom teaching his scant remaining creative writing students, all of whom are intent on cranking out gory sci-fi epics, Fitger must put up with the sound of wrecking balls and clouds of particulate matter stirred up by construction crews busy remodeling the already swanky economics department upstairs. As Fitger discloses in a ranting aside within one of his recommendation letters, his own dank office is situated conveniently adjacent to the men's room, so that my writing and research are invariably conducted to the flushing of waste. Schumacher has a sharp ear for the self-pitying eloquence peculiar to academics like the fictional Fitger, who feel that their genius has never gotten its due. His resentment seeps out between the lines of the recommendation letters he relentlessly writes or ineptly fills out on computerized questionnaires, urging RV parks and paintball emporiums to hire his graduating English majors for entry-level management positions. Inventive as all these letters are, Schumacher is smart enough to sidestep the danger posed by the inherently static form of a collection of letters. Instead, as Fitger's recommendation letters grow more elaborately unhinged, we learn more about his background, and his character develops beyond the one-note academic burnout case. Dear Committee Members serves up the traditional comic situations of classic academic farces like David Lodge's Small World and Kingsley Amis's immortal Lucky Jim. But it also updates the genre to include newer forms of indignity within the halls of academe. Take, for instance, this gem of a recommendation Fitger writes on behalf of a young colleague applying for a teaching position in comp rhetoric at another college. Alex Ruffel has prevailed upon me to support his teaching application to your department, which, I gather, is hiring adjunct faculty members exclusively, bypassing the tenure track with its attendant health benefits, job security, and salaries on which a human being might reasonably live. Perhaps your institution should cut to the chase and put its entire curriculum online, thereby sparing Ruffel the need to move. You could prop him up in a broom closet in his apartment, poke him with the butt end of a mop when you need him to cough up a lecture on Caribbean fiction or the passive voice, and then charge your students $1,000 each to correct the essays their classmates have downloaded from a website. Such is the future of education. Like the best works of farce, academic or otherwise, Dear Committee Members deftly mixes comedy with social criticism and righteous outrage. By the end, you may well find yourself laughing so hard it hurts.
Maureen Corrigan teaches literature at Georgetown University and is the author of the forthcoming book, So We Read On, How the Great Gatsby Came to Be and Why It Endures. She reviewed Dear Committee Members by Julie Schumacher.
Next, we have the story of a man with a foot in two worlds. His name is Eric Liu. He is a former presidential speechwriter who served President Bill Clinton. He's American-born to parents who were Chinese immigrants, and now he's a father himself. He's been thinking a lot about what it means to be Chinese-American, what it means to receive that legacy, what it means to pass it on. He calls his new book, A Chinaman's Chance. With that title, Eric Liu takes control of an old and prejudiced saying. His Chinese father used it all the time.
By the time I came along and was a kid, it became practice in our household for him just to use this phrase in this sort of devilish, ironic way. If the Yankees were down by five in the ninth inning, oh, they've got a Chinaman's chance of winning this game. Or, you know, if we were trying to get to ShopRite before closing time, but we were still 10 minutes away, oh, you've got a Chinaman's chance of getting there on time. But what he taught me was wit can neuter malice, right?
When you grab that phrase, you own it, and then it can't hurt you the same way.
Exactly. And I think that's the bigger lesson of just how any American can take words, language that are meant to be used to hurt them and claim them in ways that change their meaning and context.
Now, let's make sure people know your family history. Your father was an immigrant from China, is that right?
That's right.
And your mother also?
My mother as well, yep.
Okay, and you were born in the United States.
I was born in the U.S.
And you now have a teenage daughter.
I do.
And so you've had an opportunity to think about what it meant to be an American for your father, what it means to be an American for you and for your daughter. How does that change as you go from one generation to another?
Well, I actually would even extend it one generation further. My father's father, his name in Chinese is Liu Guoyun. Liu is my family name. Mm-hmm. And Guoyun translates roughly as deliverance of the nation. So, you know, a low-pressure name.
Yeah, sure.
And he grew up the son of a farmer in rural China and came of age at a time when dynastic rule was ending and the Republic of China was forming. And he felt in earnest that he did have to live up to that name. And
we're talking about before the communist era, before World War II, before all of that.
Exactly. And my grandfather joined the military. He worked with Americans to launch the Flying Tigers program.
Wow.
And so I heard all of these legends of my grandfather. Growing up, I would think to myself, as a Liu and as an American, what does it mean for me to deliver a nation? And which nation? It didn't take very long for me to realize this nation,
the United States.
This is where I've grown up. This is the place I know. And my sense of Americanness is complete. But the meaning of Americanness is completely infused by my Chineseness, right? And this is where, for my father and my mother as well, their notions of what it meant to claim this country had to do with just this question of how much do you hold on to? How much do you try to pass on? And our household was this real hybrid mix where my parents would speak about 80% Chinese and 20% English to me, and I would respond in reverse ratio.
Mm-hmm. I've noticed that in a lot of cultures. I mean, the word Spanglish is popularly known. You're talking about something a little different, though, aren't you? You're in Chinese for a little while, you're in English for a little while, you surf back to Chinese again.
Well, and that's right. And one of the ways in which Chineseness was passed on to me is just an appreciation for rhythm and the flow and the structure of language.
And
so much is understood by context. This awareness of the web of obligations that we are woven into, which you find in Chinese language, which you find in Chinese values, you find in Chinese ways of raising families, is, I think, actually something that the United States could use a giant corrective dose of right now. We are flying apart centrifugally in this age of radical inequality. We have less than ever to hold us together in a time of rapid demographic change, paying attention a bit less to rugged individualism and a bit more to context and mutual obligation is something that I think Chinese Americans can bring to the table. Right
I like now. That you say a bit less and a bit more, because, of course, we have the stereotype of Americans as individualists and the stereotype of Chinese as being more collective. But, of course, each stereotype could be true of the other as well.
You're right. Stereotypes can only take you so far. But at the same time, the United States, for all, you know, our provenance, is we were born out of a big bang against tyranny. And so everything in our language, everything in our politics proceeds from this sense of don't tread on me. And I think the way that that reverberates can be taken to extremes and can be unhealthy for any community, any society, just the same way that in China, an emphasis on relationship, obligation, the collective, so forth, that can be taken to an extreme as well. But here's the difference. The United States, in theory, retains this deep, enduring competitive advantage. America makes Chinese Americans. China does not make American Chinese. Here in the United States, it is the very point of our cultural operating system to take your forebears and my forebears and have us meld and mesh in ways that create diverse, complicated new hybrids and be the testbed for the rest of the planet.
I want to use your delightful phrase, making Chinese Americans, because you went out and you became a dad. You made a Chinese American. What's that been like?
You know, it's been great in so many ways. The key word that you used earlier in terms of her identity and our relationship is not so much Chinese American, but teenager.
Mm-hmm.
As with any teenager, this sense that Olivia, my daughter right now, is finding and defining her own identity, in part recognizing what's been passed on and in part pushing against what's been passed on.
Sure.
And raising Olivia to understand and appreciate some of this Chinese cultural inheritance boils down in some ways to language. From the time she was little, I started taking her to a Chinese school on weekends. And, you know, I have a line in my book that says, you know, those who ignore Chinese school are doomed to repeat it.
There are, at this point, I don't know how many million Chinese Americans in the United States. How do you think Chinese Americans have already changed this country?
Chinese Americans have been shaping and changing this culture from minute one. There are the obvious literal monuments to that, the Transcontinental Railroad.
Sure.
But if you just fast forward to our contemporary moment, we are a few months away from a new sitcom that will be airing on ABC called Fresh Off the Boat, based on the memoir by Eddie Huang, the restaurateur and celebrity chef in New York City. He wrote this memoir a few years back that described his very iconoclastic upbringing, defying all stereotypes. And to me, the larger point is that Chinese Americans are changing our picture of who an American is. And when you have shows like Fresh Off the Boat on network TV, when you have people like my friend and mentor Gary Locke, our former ambassador to the United States, who literally represent the United States and the rest of the world, our picture of who is us begins to change. And it no longer becomes as often the case that Chinese Americans or Asian Americans in general are to be presumed foreign until proven otherwise.
Yeah.
My goal and the point of this book is to say we should be presumed American, and then our job is to prove it.
Eric Liu is the author of A Chinaman's Chance. Thanks for coming by.
Thank you so much, Steve.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Steve Inskeep.
And I'm David Greene.